Can you hear me? Brilliant. I think we'll just start and we'll let the stragglers come in as we've already begun. So, thank you so much for giving up your warm spring / summer evening to come over here to the station, to this Bristol Cable event. It's a great privilege and an honour to be joined by Gary Young. I don't think he needs much in the way of introduction. This room's packed out. But he's an award-winning journalist, broadcaster, author, editor-at-large for The Guardian. And I think it's fair to say that he's become one of the most authoritative columnists digging beneath the surface of some of the key issues of our time. He's reported on a range of issues, from US politics to the far right, knife and gun crime, Brexit to gay marriage. And at The Cable, one of the things that interests us is not just reporting on events, but trying to understand why and how they happen and bringing them to life. And I think that's something that Gary Young has really demonstrated through his journalism, particularly through the use of kind of personal accounts that rarely see the light of day, making stories that perhaps seem old or repetitive, new and compelling and essential for people to debate and to read. This talk is going to be kind of focused on the power of narratives in terms of shaping public opinion and kind of looking at the crucial components of a good story. You know, one of the things, again, that we've reflected on at The Cable is that traditional reporting so often focuses on the exception, the extraordinary, rather than the normal, looking at the freak event. And what that really means in many ways is that systemic violence and inequality, whether it's immigration policies or the closure of youth services, stabbings, fire standards in residential accommodations, are, for the most part, ignored, not reported on, deemed unnewsworthy, and that seriously let down a lot of people time and time again, and that really does need to be addressed. And Gary, you know, I guess I'm flattering you over here, but I think it's accurate, but I do think that you make the journalism of the everyday a compelling read, and I'm really interested to hear about that today. And it's something that we aspire to at The Cable, to try and revive that on a local level, on a city level, because we believe that Bristol has been missing that, apart from a few strong voices here and there. For the most part, the city has been let down in the way of public interest journalism. So this event is part of our Media Lab. So as well as being a journalism outfit in the traditional sense, we have a quarterly print edition and we publish daily online. We also run educational programs, and one of the key things that we believe is essential for the city is to be able to broaden out the pool of people who contribute and the people who write, the people who film. So this is part of a five-month program. This is the largest event within that program. For the most part, it's hands-on workshops where 13 people are being trained in the basics of feature writing, investigative skills, and off the back of that that series, they will be contributing content for The Cable and taking it forward within their own walks of life. Before I forget, fire safety. If there's a fire alarm, it's not a drill, use the back exit over there, and if you feel so inclined, I've been advised that you must go to outside H&M in Broadmead. I don't know if that's a sales pitch that CYN have wrangled with them, but no, please do that. Or use the main entrance that you came in through. So it's not often that we have close to 200 people, over 200 people in a room, so I thought I'd use this shamelessly to kind of promote the Bristol Cable's membership. For those of you who aren't members, I think about 70% of the people in this room are members, but I'll show you a sneak preview of our latest video, which hasn't really been shown anywhere else, and then we'll move over to Gary's talk, and that will be for about 20 to 30 minutes, and then there will be a Q&A and a chance for a broader discussion, which will hopefully involve many more voices here tonight.
if you've seen anything you don't like in the city and you want to get it sorted out.
To highlight stories that weren't highlighted before.
To hold powers to account.
The vision of the Bristol Cable is to inform and empower our readers and communities across Bristol by creating independent, challenging local media rooted in the city and in the public interest. We print the magazine several times a year. There are 30,000 copies which are distributed to 650 locations across the city and they're free to access. We also deliver door-to-door in various neighbourhoods throughout the city and we publish online several times a week.
In the past, the local media has been quite poor, representing the various parts of the Bristol community. And so when we heard about a new outlet being created, especially a grassroots one, then I think everybody was very interested in that.
Well, I think the mainstream media can be quite difficult to break into. The Bristol Cable offers an open door policy. So if someone is interested in the media and finding out more about journalism or how a media organisation runs, they can come in, they can get involved and they can receive training and support in doing so.
The Media Lab course was very good because it gave us an introduction into various aspects of the media.
It's given me loads more confidence in the skills that I feel that I need
to carry on and write my own things.
Although Bristol's a really great city, there are lots of issues here, much like there are in other places. And writing with the Cable means trying to address those problems.
We try and include our members and communities that are affected by things that we're covering as much as possible. That can be in members' meetings and just meeting people face to face and getting people's opinions about what's happening in their neighbourhood and what do they care about.
There are very young people, there are middle-aged people, there are older people, and everybody's voice is heard.
Which I found quite unique.
As a reporter for the Bristol Cable, I've been able to do stories on activism, on loneliness, on mental health, on community projects all over the city. It goes beyond the headlines and the sensationalist stories that the mainstream media want to show.
We need to prove that cooperatively owned independent media is sustainable in the long run.
And also the more members we have, the more democratic it is and the more representative of Bristol the Bristol Cable is.
As a Bristol Cable member, you get to decide which stories the paper should cover, where the paper's funding should come from, and who gets to advertise in the paper, all those important things.
Become a member. £1 a month to be part of it, £3 to sustain it, £5 to grow it.
So, can you hear me? Can everybody hear me? Can you hear me now? Okay. Well, first of all, thank you very much to Bristol Cable for inviting me. It is an honour for me. And when I was told, I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago, I was originally told what the mission was. I said, look, if I could, I would, but I'm in Chicago, so I can't. But when, if I'm back, then feel free to get hold of me. And then, lo and behold, I was taken up on my offer, and here I am. I want to talk about the power of stories because I think stories can change your life, and I think that stories can change the world. And I'm not. I'm really not exaggerating when I say that. I think that the power of stories cannot be underestimated, that people will die for a good story, literally die for a good story or a bad story. People go to war for stories about their country or their culture or their religion, for what they think is right. Or wrong, for their own story about justice. People will fall in love with a story, either a story about themselves or about someone else. Stories can inspire and frighten. And I want to start out by talking about what I would refer to as meta stories, the bigger stories that kind of cover all of us and that we all grapple with in a range of ways. That in when I'm asked routinely after every mass shooting in America, so do you think they'll do gun control now? I generally respond by referring to the American story and the place of the gun in the American story, that when you go to the NRA convention, the National Rifle Association convention, and you ask, as I do, so explain this to me, I'm British, I don't understand, explain it to me. To a person, they will nearly always say the same thing. Are you married? Yes. Do you have children? Yes. And then they're off to the races. Imagine somebody broke into your house, they were going to rape your wife, they were going to kill your children, they were going to steal everything you worked for. What would you do? Would you swing a bat at them? Would you call the police and wait for them to pick up your body? Or will you stand and fight? And if you're going to stand and fight, what are you going to stand and fight with? Now, the facts suggest something very, very different. The facts suggest that you're more likely to be shot if you have a gun in your house. Most people who are killed by guns shoot themselves. After that, most people who are killed by guns are actually killed by someone they know. What they should say is, are you married? Yes. Well, watch out for your wife, because she will probably be the one that shoots you. Or more usually, watch out for your husband, because he really will be the one that shoots you, given the toll of domestic violence in a country with guns. And that American story, those American stories, speak to rugged individualism, small government, masculinity, homestead, do for self, a range of things that are central to how Americans understand themselves, the stories that they've told themselves about who they are, and that those stories are more powerful than the facts, actually. And so long after the pictures of the grieving children or revelers or university students who've been massacred and their offspring and their loved ones and their colleagues, long after those pictures have left your news feed, however you see them, these stories endure. Stories can be so powerful that you can believe a story against your own reality. When reporting my most recent book about all the kids who were shot dead in one day in America, I came across a statistic that African-American men, black men, were more likely than any other men to feed their children, to read to them, to do their homework with them, to read them stories at night, and so on. And I thought, well, this cannot be. This cannot be, because I know from somewhere that African-American men, black men, have a history of being flaky, of being absent. Obama has said so. Everybody knows this. And so I scout around looking for alternative facts for another story, a different story that I'm prepared to believe. And then I have to stop myself at some point and say, but hang on, you're a black father and you do these things, and yet somehow you are believing a story against your own reality, that there's somewhere out there. How do you know this? And so that once again speaks to the power of stories, that we are in the middle, I think, of an immense battle of stories with this tale of Windrush, that Britain has a series of competing stories about itself, and one is that it hates immigrants, and the other one is that it's an incredibly tolerant society that believes in fair play. One is that it's a white country to which black people have just arrived, and the other is that it's a multicultural country. And these stories have collided because there's a policy against immigration and against immigrants, and then there's a reality of immigrants and immigration. And so for the last week, we've been telling ourselves a story. All of us, even the Daily Mail, have been telling ourselves a story about immigrants who contribute and pay taxes and have families and build communities and grow relationships and add, not take away, add. And that somehow this story has been absent from much of our political life. And then stories can both distort and include, exclude and include, I guess, distort and clarify. One of the more intriguing stories, and one of the stories that I'm proudest of, is Finding Claudette Colvin. It's a story I did in 2000. Claudette Colvin was a young woman in Montgomery, Alabama, who in 1955 was kicked off the bus and who refused, who pled not guilty. And the civil rights movement were going to run with her, but Claudette was from a working class family. She was very dark, and then she got pregnant. And so they dropped her. And I found Claudette, and I saw all the letters from around the country. She was going to be the one. When the leaflets went out after Rosa Parks was kicked off their bus, they said another woman has been kicked off the bus. That the suit against Montgomery Bus Department was Colvin versus the bus department, because C, she was the first, just the first in the alphabet. And so America told itself a story, which has been faithfully transmitted around the world, that the civil rights movement was started by an elderly lady, a nice old lady, who finished her work and was very tired and didn't want to stand up. And so she sat down and she changed the course of history. And I was at the funeral for Rosa Parks, and the various services both in Montgomery and Washington. And again they told this story of the individual, the hapless individual caught in the crosshairs of history who changes the country. What they said less of was that Rosa Parks was a full-time activist. I mean full-time, she was a seamstress too, but she was a lifelong activist who veered more towards Malcolm X than Martin Luther King, never quite got to nonviolence as a strategy, who had been kicked off that bus by that driver several times, but it never escalated to that scale. And that the stories often miss out the fact that then for the next 13 months, there was a massive collective boycott of the bus service, that this was a large number of people who did this. This was collective action. It wasn't one woman who, perhaps if she had better shoes, would have been okay standing up. Perhaps if she'd had an easier day, it would have been okay standing up. And so the story America tells itself is that individuals, atomized, isolated, they are the ones that change the world, not groups of people, not nameless groups of people whose names we might not know, but who carry us on their shoulders. And then they're not lesser stories, but they are not meta stories. And there is a phrase that you learn in journalism school, or, you know, it's quite a common phrase then. Look, when dog bites man, and it's always gendered that way, when dog bites man, that's not a story. When man bites dog, that's a story. And I understand that. What they're saying is that, look, that you know, there are things you expect to happen, and then there are things that are exceptional. But the problem with that adage, or the thing that must be added to that adage, I think, is sometimes the question, well, who owns these dogs? And Why do the same people keep being bitten? And what can we do to keep these dogs under control? That quite often, the story is the thing that keeps on happening, the thing we have become inured to, the thing that is normal. That in America, when covering the gun crime book, the gun deaths book, it transpired that there were places where black kids were not supposed to die. Cinemas, malls, schools, universities. But then there were places where if they died, it didn't actually transform your understanding of how a city or a place worked. It confirmed it, that if they died in South Dallas or in that area of Newark, well, that's where young black people die. And so it's not really a story. And so when I would call the journalist who had written the story and say, do you have any leads that you would be prepared to share? Is there anyone I might talk to? They'd say, well, I didn't really follow it up because it's not much of a story if it happens down there. This is the story of Black Lives Matter in America. The problem is not that more black people are being killed. It's actually around the same rate black people who are being shot by the police. It's that we have now decided to pay attention. And so what was banal and commonplace and everyday has become obscene and outrageous because we've decided that we will not support that story anymore. That's more or less what happened with Windrush. That these stories were broken. They started breaking them about 5 months ago. There's no new information out there. What has changed is, and the mistake that the government made wasn't that they were pursuing these people. That was entirely consistent with their hostile environment policy, where anybody who is a migrant is guilty of being illegal unless they can prove that they're not. That's the policy. It's not a glitch in the system, that's the system. The mistake that they made was underestimating the moral force of the Windrush generation and getting caught. That was the mistake. And so, in all sorts of ways, there are powerful stories around us really waiting, begging to be told. In that, there are stories of people who we don't hear from, of individuals who, I don't like the term voice of the voiceless, because it's not that they don't have a voice, it's that nobody's listening. But that who aren't spoken to amazingly. It's not like people were trying to beat down Claudette Colvin's door. That most of the kids in the book that I wrote about all of the kids who were shot dead in America in one day, nobody had come to see them. No journalist had come to see them. Their stories weren't worth being told. And yet people assume that they know the story. And I get this quite a lot because of the kind of stories that I tell, that quite often an editor, either at The Guardian or let's leave them out of it because they pay my wages, but an editor, wherever they may be, a book editor, if particularly when the gun book was being shopped around, and they will say, I think we know this. And I will always say, well, how do you know? How do you know, and what do you know? One of the stories in the book is about a boy called Samuel Brightman, who's 16 and who's shot dead in South Dallas. And the story about him is 80 words long, 80, 90 words long, and that's it. And below that story, a woman called Marge Bargas has a comment saying, well, I know where my kids are. And you have to ask, if adults can't do better, what's a 16-year-old boy doing out at 11:30 at night, as though there is a time when it's okay to shoot a child, as though 11 o'clock is the curfew point after which children may be shot. And then you find Samuel's mother and you find out what they were doing. And that night, Samuel's friend from school had come over to take his granny to church the next day, because the day I had chosen was a Saturday, so the next day was a Sunday. And Samuel didn't know anyone in the area, sweet, kind of fragile kid, really. And so Denzel had come over to Samuel's place, and they had drunk cocoa, played Uno, and watched We're the Millers. That the worst thing Samuel had done that night was cheat at Uno. And then he decided that he would, as a good friend might, walk Denzel half of the way home, because Denzel was staying at his granny's, and his granny's was about 8 minutes away. And in that short walk, Samuel was shot dead, and nobody knows why. His mum knew where he was, but she just couldn't save him. But according to Marge Barger, she knew that story already. It's very similar with many of the stories that I covered during the year that we did knife crime in Britain last year. And I caught up with the mother of a boy who was convicted of killing. And she showed me the letters that she had written to the local council saying, help me save my son. The conversation that she had with the social services saying, either he's going to end up dead or someone's going to end up in a body bag. The parenting courses that she went on. And the little sign-off at the bottom from the council that said, we have to make £54 million worth of cuts this year. Join us in our discussion about how we streamline our services. That there's a story for people who are interested about cuts in youth services and child and adolescent mental health services, where children who have anorexia can't be seen unless they are skinny enough. And children at risk of suicide won't be seen until they've actually tried to commit suicide. And that if you cut the youth clubs and you cut the child and adolescent mental health services and you take away the EMMAs that help to fund kids staying in school, and you have a school system that prizes a certain kind of results rather than a certain kind of outcome for a human being, then guess what? Chances are that there is going to be a social consequence to that, that we are actively underfunding our youth. And yet the story of knife crime becomes instead a story of rap and grime and culture and crime, not of young people who have been abandoned by us, their elders. The other thing that was very interesting during that year, last year, of knife crime, was realizing that there were no facts. That when we started the year, I just thought, well, let's just see how many kids died last year. I thought it would be a phone call, and it took us 11 months of lobbying and freedom of information requests and of persistence. And then finally, there were no statistics publicly available for the number of kids being killed by knives, which, given the amount of ink spilt and speeches made in Parliament, really makes you wonder what they were talking about, because they didn't know anything. And then what we found was very interesting, because in 2007, Tony Blair went to Cardiff, and he said, let's not pretend that it's not young black kids doing this. And what we found actually was that, first of all, most most of these deaths are same race deaths, so you can deduce from who's dying, who's killing, that 2/3 of the children killed by knives in Britain are not black. That half of the deaths in Britain are in London and the other half are outside. And the overwhelming majority of those in London are black, but the overwhelming majority of those outside London, and I'm talking 85 to 90%, are not black. And so we'd been having this conversation about black kids in London, which was entirely skewed and distorted. And so I think there is power in correcting stories, in presenting other stories, in showing that the child who killed is a child who killed and not a killer, that he's not defined by his crime, that he has a mother and a family and a past and hopefully a future. And that the kids in these stories are children. They're not metaphors. They are not cautionary tales, that you can't learn much about how to stop the next child being killed if you aren't very interested in why the last child was killed. And that to do that, you have to be open to their stories. You don't have to indulge their stories. You don't have to excuse their actions, but you need to want to know what happened. Wrapping up very quickly, I just want to talk a little bit about what I think, because I know there may be some journalists in here, what I think makes a good story. I think they need to be simple. Not stupid, but simple. Tell the story about the thing that you're telling the story about. Don't tell 6 or 7 stories in one story. Tell one story well and properly, that you don't need necessarily big words or long sentences to tell a story. Make it easy on your reader. Lead them through the story. Make it straightforward. That it's much harder to write simply and clearly than it is, and short than it is to write long and waffly and in a highfalutin way. This will seem obvious, but often in the reading I think it's not so obvious. Be as engaging as you can, that you are trying to get someone's attention here. And so that will involve mixing personal stories with context, and context with facts. And in that, you take people somewhere, that you make place and face and affect. You make them vivid, so that someone feels that they are with you, that you, and that you are taking them with you. Know your audience. If I was giving this talk to a group of primary school students, I would do it differently. If I was giving this talk to a group of labor activists, I would do it differently. It wouldn't be less or more, but it would be different. And I would want to have some sense of who I was talking to. Assume maximum intelligence but minimum knowledge. That people will understand anything you tell them so long as you tell them, but you have to tell them. So don't assume that they know what you know. Find the tone to fit your tale. That there are stories that don't work with humor. There are stories that work well with humor. There are opportunities to inject all kinds of things into a story, but make sure that the things that you're injecting fit with the nature of the story that you're telling. be in your story as much as you need to be and no more. That the presence of the writer can be intrusive. The cups of tea you drink, the trip that you make to the interview, well, who cares? And sometimes your absence can be confusing. That sometimes people need to know, well, how did you find that person? Or what, take me with you here. And that sometimes taking them with you means them really being with you. Be a reliable conduit for the information that you have. I studied to be an interpreter. And one of the things they would tell us about interpreting is it doesn't matter how well you're interpreting if people really don't believe that you know what you're talking about. And similarly, unless you're a trusted narrator, unless you can get the reader to trust you, then it doesn't really matter what you're saying. And finally, be yourself, because that's the one thing that nobody else can do for you. People often, when they write, try to adopt the voice of the writer. But the voice of the writer, so long as you're writing, is your voice. So use it. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for that. That was, as expected, very interesting. So we're going to go straight into a Q&A, a bit of a discussion. I'll kick off with one question, and then we'll move to the floor. So as you were talking, one of the things that kind of I was thinking about was how rarely people really change their mind on fundamental issues. I think, was it Marge who made that comment? So the question I kind of have for you is, how do you think we can get accurate, or how do we shift people off the narratives that they've already adopted? And how do we make kind of accurate public interest reporting as shareable, as read, as the sort of narratives that a lot of people kind of feel comfortable with that aren't necessarily telling the real story? Whatever the real story is, I guess.
And some of that is about, can you hear me? Some of that is about those meta-narratives that I'm talking about, which make it hard. If you live in a country where the assumption is that black kids are feral and black parents are negligent and the kids don't love life and the parents don't love their kids, then the chances are that one piece is not going to do it, and that's the kind of framing that you're up against. And if we're honest, it takes quite a lot for things to change my mind quite often. But that one of the things I think that can be quite useful is when you're done with your piece, to go through and to see how many adjectives you really need. The way you've said this disgraceful policy, maybe you should be showing and not telling. Maybe if you can illustrate why a policy is disgraceful, then you don't need to say it. And if you can illustrate it, then someone can see or not see. But that that these things, where I've changed my mind on things is because I've had a narrator that I've trusted who's kind of engaged with some of my concerns and then said, but here, I wanna show you this. Or where I've been open to different kinds of facts. So just the other day, I got an email from someone saying that he felt hoodwinked. That was the email title, just hoodwinked. And he said, I read your book thinking that, hoping to get some insight into the carnage, into the black carnage that is blighting American cities, and that you wouldn't take a side in the NRA debate. And instead, I saw a 5-page rant about the NRA and something, something, something. I don't know. I kind of did sort of stop paying attention after that. And I wrote back to him, as I rarely do in these circumstances, but I just said, well, the story was about all of the kids that were shot dead in America in one day. So I'm not sure why you thought it was a book about black carnage, but I can't help you there. As many white kids on an average day are shot dead as black kids. And I'm assuming this guy's white. I'm sure, but even if he isn't, I said, I'm sure you must be as interested in the white kids as the black kids, because I am. And then I didn't say that I was going to take an even hand with the NRA. I said, this isn't a book about gun control. It's just a book about what happens when you don't have gun control. And if you, there were 4 pages about the NRA. You know, I said, you can call it a rant if you like, but there's 4 pages about the NRA. But then the next 4 pages offer a critique of the gun control movement. But I guess you didn't get that far. Now, I don't know that, well, I do know, that book is not necessarily going to change that man's views, because that book is competing with a range of things, and people have to be ready to hear the message. With knife crime, they have a thing called the teachable moment. And the teachable moment is the moment at which a kid is most receptive to hear about the things that they can change in their life in order to cycle out of the world where they are prone to knife crime. And the teachable moment is when they've just been stabbed, in exactly the same way as the moment in which I will be most receptive to a conversation about my diet and exercise is when I have a heart attack. Before then, the most dangerous place to be is between me and a burger. But after then, I will, in the immediate aftermath, I will be listening. And so people have to be ready to listen. And then you, as a writer, have to be ready to take them on the next journey. And the truth is that that might not be you. It might be someone else who can do that, because there's someone else who is writing in a way or is writing about the kind of things that they are open to.
Okay, so we'll take... I would ask for people to keep your questions or your comments as concise as possible so we let as many people speak. I'll take 3 people and then Gary can answer them. Person over there, yes. And we'll go to you next. And is there anybody else afterwards? And the woman at the front. Yes?
Gary, you started off talking about the collision of two stories. In the nation's storytelling about the anti-immigration and about being a country that values fair play. My question is, do you have any thoughts on how we can access, activate, mobilize the story of being a country of fair play and use that politically?
The man in the red shirt.
Have a mic if you want.
Yeah, take it away.
Hold it quite close.
Okay. When you put your work on your website, is there any sense in which you change it, or do you feel that being online, the content has to be in some formal sense different? That's one quick question. The other one is your thoughts about Facebook. In terms of, we all know about the commercial and the advertising and what that is about, but I've also found it interesting that you can put a story up on Facebook, but you can also, if there's a campaign around housing, or something similar, you can also get activists out quickly. So you can tell a story, but part of the story is also action for the future.
Thank you. And the one at the front over here.
Thank you, Gary. That was really a very, very interesting presentation. You're talking about the responsibility as a writer. I'd like to ask you, what is the responsibility of a reader? When we're reading what we know to be a story that's unfair or unjust, how can we balance against that as a reader? Do we continue reading and try and... I took offence at something Amanda Platel wrote fairly recently about Stormzy, and I wrote back to her. But of course, there was no response, but I heard you say you rarely write back. I'm sure you're inundated. But how do we try and address from a reader's point of view?
In terms of how do we mobilise politically around the notion of fair play, I think I would want to mobilise around something a bit different, which would be the notion of that we are actually a country of immigration, and that we always have been, and that those things that we are celebrating in the Windrush generation, if you look back to the time when they arrived, there were very, very similar anxieties to the time we have now. And so we have shown that we are better than this by getting this far, that we can either learn the lessons of the last 70 years or we can repeat the mistakes of the last 70 years. But that there is miraculously a good news story in this whole mess, which is they endured, and through a range of means, there is an understanding now that wasn't the case then, that we are better for them having endured. And so, look at where we are now, and look at where we could be in another 70 years if we decide to embrace this moment rather than resist it. I think the struggle with the notion that we are a country of fair play is that it's evidently, from what's happened to these people with Windrush, we're really not. And that one of the things that has to be accepted, and I kind of do enjoy with the kind of partisan hat, the embarrassment of the Conservative Party in this moment, but actually, when those votes took place, there was, in 2014, there was a significant amount of consensus that that was the right thing to do. Only 6 Labour MPs voted against it, of whom there was Corbyn, Abbott, McDonnell, and David Lammy, interestingly. That 2014 was the year when UKIP were the biggest party in the European Union elections, and so we have to accept that we didn't come to this point just by the there was license to treat people this way. And actually, if you listen to what the Conservatives, the kind of narrowly tailored apology, what they're saying is, we didn't mean to be hostile to you. We meant to be hostile to them.
Yeah.
And that's unacceptable. I don't change my stuff that goes online unless it's got a mistake in it, in which case I do pretty quick. I filed my column today, actually, and the nature of filing column at The Guardian, I've already got in trouble for doing this once, so I'm assuming I can't really get in trouble for doing the same thing twice. You send in your story, you follow up, and you say, did you get my story? And they say, have we got Gareth? Yeah, you're good. That's it. Sometimes they'll come back with a query. Sometimes they don't. Next you see it's online. You don't know when it's going online. Might go online at 6 o'clock in the morning. Might go online at 11 o'clock at night. And it's... Exactly. Sometimes the online version is longer because it can be, because it doesn't have the space restraints. And so now we do file stories with optional cuts, So you write a story, because, and also you don't know where it's going to go on the page. So you'll write a story at 1,150 words with an optional cut of 150 words, so that if they want to put it in a 1,000-word slot, they can. And but the 1,150 words will appear online. So that's the only difference. And then social media, in a range of ways, has proved a very, very effective organizing tool. Now, we know from the news of the last kind of month or so that it's not an unproblematic medium, but social media has caffeinated the way that we can interact. It is the way that, and it enables alternate stories to get out. That social media is how Black Lives Matter happened. It's how Trayvon Martin became a national scandal. And to some extent, it, and I think for the most part, social media explains how things get caffeinated. It doesn't explain why they exist. It explains why they can be amplified. But I do think social media does explain to some extent how the Corbyn phenomenon was amplified. That there was a, that the media has shown itself, the official media, the mainstream media, has shown itself to be an inadequate conduit for the national conversation. And so those conversations are taking place elsewhere. And at times, it becomes clear that the conversations that are taking place elsewhere are bigger and more relevant than the ones that are taking place in the mainstream media. And Facebook and Twitter and so on are very, you know, can be very, very powerful ways of doing that and of organizing. Of saying, well, let's do this. Who's in? And then you find suddenly that you were not alone shouting at your telly, or you were, but there were a range of other people shouting at their telly around where you live or elsewhere. And before you know it, you have something that can, you know, be activated. The challenge with that is that these social media phenomena tend to be very ephemeral. They exist for as long as the hashtag exists, or for as long as that page exists. And so, because they are virtual, they can burn very brightly and then fade just as much. And so we've kind of, I do think in the progressive world, our movements are more flight of foot, but arguably the flip side of that is that they are less sturdy, they have less history. Each time you're kind of reinventing the wheel to some extent, and that is a problem. And then the responsibility of the reader is a very good question. I mean, there's a bit of me that this is a personal thing; it's not an advocacy thing. I just kind of don't read that stuff because it makes me crazy. So, I'm not claiming that that's.
You need to read and review. All right,
and I'm not even claiming that that's a strategy. That's my psychological strategy. That is not a kind of political strategy. If I broaden the question out to viewers as well as readers, and you look at what happened, for example, with Parkland, where a couple of people were taken off the air when they started trashing the Parkland kids, and there was a boycott, call for a boycott, that went viral. People say, I don't want to be associated with this show anymore. That there can be power in that, and that while you don't get a response always, or often, it is quite often noted, and it's felt. If there's, and the trouble is sometimes these people, these organisations can be so amoral that it's just like, oh, that was a big postbag. You know, and so-and-so is quote-unquote controversial, not a bigot, just controversial. And so it is beyond not buying the paper, not giving them any money, not giving them any clicks. It's tricky. It's tricky because you don't want to encourage it by engaging. But what I would say is, in these things, quite often no energy is ever lost. And a little bit like I said before, you don't know how many other people are doing that. And that's how they suddenly work out that they're beyond the pale. There was a really interesting moment in 1998, I think, when Peter Mandelson was outed by accident, on, like nobody knew, on Newsnight, I think. And then there was this head of steam about how many gay men there were in the cabinet, how many gay people there were in the cabinet. And the Mirror did this thing like, we need, I think it was Paul Routledge, we should be told who's gay and who's not in the cabinet because there could be a cabal of gay people in the cabinet. It's completely insane. Anyway, this was the, it was a front page column idea, and then you could phone in, 0800, kill all gay people, or 0800 something else, I don't care. And then the next day, the answer was kind of parked somewhere in the back of the newspaper that most people didn't care. And this was an example of them completely misjudging their readership, which, and one doesn't have to support or not support Corbyn to understand this, which was also true with Corbyn, that they threw everything that they had at Corbyn and Labour, and then the clock struck 10 on election night, and it was like, oh, we are not as powerful as we thought we were. And so that notion that these people are agenda setters, I think has been punctured pretty conclusively over, certainly over the past kind of 2 or 3 years.
Okay, anyone else?
I'm going to take green, black and blue over there.
Hi, thank you for your talk. I'm just interested in the role of emotion in getting people to, say, vote against their own vested interests. So I was talking to someone the other day whose mother is an immigrant from Europe and voted to leave the EU. And Donald Trump is polling record highs amongst white evangelicals in the USA, despite not being anything really that is like an upstanding Christian man. So I just wondered what your thoughts on emotion were on that.
I just wanted to ask, my father's 89, and I don't think he's changed his opinion for at least 79 years. And he reads the Daily Mail, and he's probably read it as long as it's been around. So my question is a little bit linked to this lady is, I work in schools. How can we teach children to be better readers, more intelligent readers, more investigative readers? Because actually at school mainly now we're encouraging them not to read around a subject, but just to get the best marks they can. And I just worry about how we're going to change a generation of people who read the wrong news.
Hi, thank you for your talk. So rings true on so many levels. But you said that to have a good story, you need to be short. But Bristol Cable's not noted for its short stories. It has length. And there's a question about how do you incorporate nuance and subtlety in a short story? And to what extent is there room for long stories without alienating us in an age where we have such short attention spans?
I did say, but I didn't really mean that they all have to be short. What I mean is, quite often people write too long, and they write too long because it's easier to write long, and that to maintain someone's attention over a longer period of time, I'm actually beginning to quite enjoy the essay form, which is bigger than an article but less than a book. But it's very difficult. And it's difficult because you are still charged with engaging someone over a significant period of time. And so most of the things that people write can be shorter, and that you should need a good reason to write long, I think. And there are good reasons to write long, as you mentioned, nuance and subtlety, and you know, when you're writing about people with messy lives, you kind of have to, you know, you have to contextualize. But too often, when people write long, it's because they can't be bothered to edit, and people say, "Well, I just can't possibly, I couldn't possibly make it any shorter." And you just think, "Give it to me, I'll make it shorter." And it's telling, and I don't think we should pander to this, but it's just worth understanding. At The Guardian, there's a doohickey that we can use, and you can see roughly how many people have read your, well, how many people have clicked on your stuff, where they are, not their street address, you know, Google for that, but you know if they're in Bristol or Edinburgh or whatever, or in Australia or. But it also has reading time, and it tells you, on average, someone would, you know, an article this length should take 3 minutes to read, and then there is a very humbling, the median time that people spend reading this article was, and sometimes like 50 seconds or a minute, and kind of that's what you're up against, and quite often if it's clickbait and it's got a source headline, it's like 5 seconds because people click on it and then they think, oh, I thought that was going to be good and it's not, well, I've seen the picture and that's it. But that, and you have to ask yourself, and it's the same with videos, when they're longer, kind of less people watch them, so why are you doing this long thing that very few people will read? And sometimes the way around that is, well, fair enough, they're going to The Guardian, they're going very quickly, but if it's in cable or if it's in London Review of Books, well, London Review of Books, when you sit down to that, you are kind of inculcating yourself, you are getting ready for a big read. So some of that is about the medium, but it's because it's easier to write long that I feel it's necessary to talk about writing short. I don't think people have a problem writing long. The thing about encouraging people to, your dad and him not changing his mind, and I mean, one thing I would ask, I don't know that I change my mind about that many things. I wonder if you do. You know, I wonder how many people in this room have changed their mind about Brexit or about how they vote, or lots of people don't, and that's about stories that people tell themselves about who they are and what, you know, and what that means. But I do think that, and I completely, my son is doing his SATs at the moment, or SATs are happening. I don't know how much he's doing. And that horror of having an 11-year-old stressed and saying to him, just really, don't worry about it. But then he's going to school and everybody's worrying about it and they're kind of, you know, it's a nice school, but they're still, that's what they're doing. It's like when people say to kids, it doesn't matter who wins and loses at this game, now go out and win. Schools are not the intellectually nurturing place that they were, and that's not teachers' fault. That's the way that things have been framed. I wish when, and I was lucky enough to have friends who would help me with this when I was older, but I wish when I was younger that I had had more experience of discussion and debate, not the kind of debate with lecterns, but a way, particularly as a boy, stroke young man, of stepping down, saying, right, I see your point. Well, how would that work? Or, you know, there are classy ways to not necessarily change your mind in that moment, but engage. And schools that are about building good citizens would be able to do that. But schools that are about getting good marks, not so much. And then the thing about voting against vested interests, I'm always intrigued by, because I vote against my material interests. I vote Labour. I'd be better off if I voted Tory. But there's voting Tory is not in my story. And there are other things I vote for. And I think we, so that there is that about voting, that kind of, if you believe that abortion is murder, then the fact that you are poor may not stop you from voting for someone who's anti-abortion, even if, you know, it's against your material interest, because that's what you believe. Because people's material interests aren't necessarily the primary thing that they're voting on. It's not the primary thing I vote on. And I voted to remain, but my vote to remain was not an endorsement of the EU by any manner of means. And I think there were logical reasons why people voted to leave. And one of the things I do try and do in my work. And my American family, my wife's American, and my American family are like, how could you sit and listen to those Republicans say that all the time? And I said, because I genuinely want to know what makes them tick, is trying to find out why people do things that seem kind of irrational to me. Because either I'm the only sane person in the room, or they have a logic that I'm just not getting. And I really do want to understand it. And there are people, black Republicans, Latinos who voted for Trump, where I'm like, take me on the journey with you. I'm bringing a seatbelt, but I really, I'm interested. And the other thing that has to be accepted, and there's kind of been kind of blown open, I think, in the last little while with the way elections have gone, is what's the other offer? That if you say to a poor white American who believes who is against abortion, why are you voting against your interests? And they say, well, look at what the Democrats did. They did NAFTA. They did this, they did that. They weren't really supporting me. If you look at kind of an immigrant here or child of an immigrant and say, why aren't you voting Labour? And they say, well, they voted with the Tories in 2014 to get, you know, then they've not been that great for me. And so there is also the question of what else is out there. So I vote. I think people generally should vote. But I do understand quite often sometimes why people don't, because sometimes there's not enough, they don't feel there's enough to vote for, and they feel that they're voting against something rather than for something, and so on. So I think the issue of vested interests is tricky, because I'm sure that you don't just vote for your material concerns. You have a broad outlook of how you think society should be, and that there are competing visions of that. And actually the one that says, I find myself increasingly with children quite conservative domestically, talking to my kids about personal responsibility, and you know, you put that back, and you know, everybody has to pay in their fair share, and why should it? Arguments that I make in the house that I wouldn't make about the country at large. And so that might just be me getting old or me being bad, but I kind of feel like I get it a bit more now than I did before.
All right, I think we're going to have two more questions because we're running tight on time. So Lorna, do you want to pick two people? This man over here and a woman in the back.
I'm gutted we're running out, gutted that we're running out of time because it's a fascinating evening. Thank you, Gary. I think my question's about authenticity, and I liked your response to the question earlier about social media uncovering a story that wasn't being told by the establishment, the established media. But what's been worrying me is that that can go the other way, can't it? Or I'm asking the question, can that go the other way? Tonight, you can file a story about tonight's events. If you go AWOL in so doing, your sub-editor, your editor, your peer community, your institution of professionals within your media organ will stop you publishing that, probably, or it'll be modified. If we all went away tonight from this event publishing a complete load of lies and rubbish about what Gary Young said to Bristol Cable on the whatever the date is tonight, that would be published. We've all got the right to publish these days. So my question, especially in the context of the media crisis, of print media, you know, having less and less commercial prospects and the move inevitably towards internet, not that I'm anti-internet, but I haven't used the phrase fake news, but what can we do about that problem of authenticity? And isn't that the other side of that social media coin, that the power of the people can be incredibly destructive in telling stories which are just nuts, as opposed to stories which are based on those values that you articulated in your talk about truth?
Right now? Hi, I'm Stacey. I'm here with Ujima Radio. And from Oklahoma. So I've heard you say before, Gary, that the American system is broken. I was just curious when you think it did break. And as an optimistic American, what would you advise a non-journalist how to use effective writing strategies to try to fix it?
Small questions. I think the first thing we have to acknowledge with the media and the issue of fake news is that the media has fallen short. That kind of fake news meme, which is now the right, actually I think started on the left with Iraq and people actually not believing what they were reading with good reason. That kind of the notion that you shouldn't trust the mainstream media if you look at coverage of recent events or their ability to predict what's going on, that kind of all-knowing, omnipresent way of, you know, that tone has been found lacking, that we all knew that Trump would. We just didn't know them because they're not us, you know. And we knew that Cameron wasn't going to win. And you know, and this one I can absent myself from, knew that Corbyn was going to be a disaster. And you know, at the last election, and I, a couple of times in the paper, would say. If you called the last election right, if you thought that Labour was going to be where it is in Scotland 4 years ago, if you called Brexit, if you called Trump, then you get to talk to me about the next 4 years. But if you did not call those, then stop trying to be predictive, because you're obviously not very good at it, and instead be descriptive. Because the world is a really interesting place right now, and our job is to be curious. So, while you're predicting what's going to happen in the future, all this stuff is going on in the present, and you're missing it. And I think that in the absence of social medium, everybody being able to publish, in a moment of crisis, the media has shown to be as out of touch as it probably always was, actually, but that is more evident in a crisis than it would be when things are rumbling along. And so some of that criticism comes from a real place, even if it then goes on to lack honesty. And there is an elitism in the British media. There is. So there is that too, and they do draw from the same kind of social class as the political class. And so it doesn't do us to deny that. And then you have the thing about what people would rather believe than the truth. And there is a way to connect to that is to look at how that happens in liberal worlds or on the left. So the Russian investigation becomes, the Russians for many become the reason why Hillary lost. Not because she didn't go to Michigan, the Russians didn't tell her not to go to Michigan or Wisconsin, or Facebook didn't tell her to do certain things. You know, that Cambridge Analytica, and the margins have been so narrow with so many of these elections, that it could be that these things tip the balance. It could be that they tipped us over the edge. But the question still stands, why were we so close to the edge? What were we doing there? What were we even, how did we get to a world where Donald Trump was even plausible? And so if you look at how liberals will latch on to comfort blankets, then we can see that there can be a rationale for these things even when they're wrong. And I think the way that we counter this is my argument, my little kind of campaign in the newsroom, is to be better and to be responsive. And actually, what the Guardian's been doing, I think, has been really interesting with its membership scheme. And those, just as a little poll out of interest, how many of you read the Guardian online more than 3 times a week? Okay. Now, how many of you pay the Guardian any money? Okay, so that's about a fifth of the people who put their hands up. And yet we do have to exist. And to do the long stories, to do the knife crime stories where you sit in a court for 5 or 6 days or longer and then spend a week, chasing someone, that takes time and money and, a range of resources. That finding out how many kids got killed in a year, well, that there was a data journalist who did all those freedom of information requests. And that's why those things pop up at the end of your story saying, maybe you want to give us some money. And there were a lot of debates within the building about whether we should do that. But the alternative was a paywall. And then, and we'd rather that our journalism was open. And actually, it's kind of worked. Obviously, it's not worked enough. But that does demand something of us too, which is then to be more responsive. If we are going to be funded more by readers voluntarily than we are by advertising, which is basically just kind of gone through the floor, then we're going to have to be responsive to readers in a way that we are responsive to advertising. Advertisers don't decide our content, but we do, our advertising department do meet with advertisers and kind of talk about what they're doing and what, how we might work together and all that kind of stuff. And to me, that's a kind of interesting and hopeful project about where we might go next. and it, to some extent answering a few of the questions about how do you change people's minds, if people want to believe that Obama was a terrorist or a Muslim or, I don't know, that Hillary Clinton ate babies or whatever they want to believe, they're going to, I don't know that a story is going to change their mind. But the turning of the world as we see it might. And one of the things that I've seen about those memes as they go around is that they're broad but that they're thin. That lots of people say, oh, I think Obama, he was born abroad. You know, but they're not actually kind of necessarily massively invested in it. And we can see, if we look at the Windrush story, how these things, with a different framing, can turn on a dime. And so I don't think most people would say in this country, I've changed my mind about immigration. But over the last week, they've definitely changed their conversation about immigration. And that actually creates a possibility that they might change their mind. America being broken. I mean, you know, first of all, I wrote that because I was writing about America. I could just as easily write about Britain being broken and write about why. So it's not, it wasn't from a lofty gaze. But that in terms of America's politics, when you have that amount of money in politics, and when your congressional seats are nearly all gerrymandered, and when you have a Senate that was built on kind of many slavey kind of on fears about kind of, you know, how slavery is going to play out. And when you are only just more than 50 years off being an apartheid state, I think you've got a lot of work to do. You know, not you personally, but I think America does a very good job of traveling light from its history and saying, oh, you know, yeah, racism, we're done with that now. And Vietnam, that was sad. Now it's over. Now we're moving on to something else. And I'm just moving on. And it's one of the things that I really like about it, but it also kind of drives you crazy because, of course, as you move on, you take your baggage with you and people's lives don't move on necessarily. The legacy of slavery and, you know, it was a slave state for 200 years and an apartheid state for 100 years. It's only been a non-racial democracy for 50 years and yet people are like, we're done with that. It's like, well, you may be done with it, but Detroit isn't. So, with the specific issue of America, I think that I think I was kind of referring specifically to its electoral politics, and that its electoral politics are kind of undermined by a massive amount of money and a massive amount of rigging. And I don't know that anybody denies that there's a huge amount of money and a huge amount of rigging going on, even if they think it's okay because it works in their interest. And then how progressives change that? Well, I do think in the last few years we've seen this miraculous kind of swell of activism, and in a sense Trump has kind of concentrated people's minds. I think four of the five biggest national demonstrations in America have taken place in the last year and a half. That more women are standing as candidates than we've seen in ages. That with Bernie Sanders, there was this poll, I was in Iowa for the the caucuses, something like 64% of Iowa Democrats define themselves as socialist. You're like, well, where the hell did that come from? And so, and I spent a lot of time in Muncie, Indiana, and I was there in January, and I covered Muncie in the month before the election. Every Democrat or liberal that I met was doing something more than they'd done before. They were voting, they were phone banking, they were lobbying, they were doing something more. And so I think this moment, this Trumpian moment, has concentrated people's minds on where, because Trump in so many ways is just, he's not just anything because he's so oversized, but he is a vulgar and ostentatious version of what has come before. He's kind of, you know, that there is more than a little of the George Bush about him, actually, and then some, but that people have been so freaked out that they have been forced to kind of reckon with, and this is a good place to stop, with the notion that maybe America needs a different story. That maybe the story of wealth and force and individualism and masculinity and the things that have kind of dominated American politics for so long, that we can tell a different story about ourselves that is more inclusive, that is better, that is less isolating and more hopeful. And that is what I think is getting people out, demonstrating, standing, lobbying, phone banking, is taking control of their lives and telling themselves there must be a better story for us because this story is just not working.
Yeah, thanks again, Gary, for that. That was an incredible talk. And to everyone who's come down tonight, thank you very much as well. To the team at the station, we really appreciate all of your assistance. And to the Bristol Cable team who made this possible. And of course, to the members who make every day at the Bristol Cable a reality, thank you to you. The Centre for Investigative Journalism, they're also funders of the, I forgot to mention, they're funders of the Media Lab programme. So a big shout out to them. Gary talking earlier about the Guardian's membership model, they copied us. we did actually get an email from Alan Rusbridge, the former editor, in the early days of that. But if you're not a member of the Bristol Cable, hopefully you might feel that way inclined to join tonight after this inspiring session. Unfortunately, Gary isn't one of our columnists, but we do aspire to the journalism that we've been discussing tonight. It's very easy to join, thebristolcable.org/join. And for people who are already members, the AGM, the most exciting AGM you'll ever go to. as far as AGMs go, obviously, but is May 14th at the Malcolm X Centre in St. Paul's. So please come down to that. 6:30 p.m. And it will be advertised on social media and members will receive emails ahead of the event. But just put it in your calendars. Take any rubbish with you as you leave, and once again, thank you, Gary.